Good afternoon. I'm Mike Nichols with the National Business Aviation Association. It's my pleasure to welcome you to our first session of the afternoon. It's surely a beautiful day outside, so I thank you all for coming inside to spend some time listening about international flight planning. We're pleased this afternoon to have with us Laura Everington, who is a senior trip support specialist with Universal Weather and Aviation out of Houston, Texas. Laura's going to focus on a worldwide review, but spend some time talking about U.S. Customs and Border Protection, MCL and APIS, and the Visa Waiver Program. Laura, thank you very much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you all very much for coming out this afternoon. I trust that everybody's full with the fine food we had out here. This is a worldwide review. But for the first half hour, we're going to touch briefly, because with the time constraints, we obviously, with a worldwide review, can't go into a lot of detail. But it's pretty informative, and if you got any questions along the way, because the first half of it will move fairly quickly. Most of you in the audience and in the business you're in are most familiar with a lot of this stuff anyway, so it'll just be a recap. But we will start with operations into Europe. As far as permits go, private flights, Part 91 operators, permits are not required in most countries in the EU. Charter flights, however, a landing permit is required, and the information required for your service provider or yourself to send with that request is going to be, of course, all of the company and aircraft information, as well as your worldwide insurance and a full crew and passenger manifest. The civil aviation authorities will then send the landing permission to you. Sometimes it will be a verbal, sometimes it will be a number, depending on the area that you're flying around in and landing in. If you do use a service provider and they send you a verbal confirmation, that verbal confirmation is as good as gold. It's just like having a number, because you've got the name of the entity within civil aviation who authorized it. Airport restrictions within Europe, there's a lot of them, as everybody is well aware. Slot restrictions, many curfews. The best thing to do if you use a service provider or you do it yourself is to call anytime. The curfews change depending on the airport, depending on the traffic flow, depending on events in the area. So it's always good to check just prior to a trip, even if you have information at your fingertips, as like a UV trip planner or an AccuQuick, something such as that. It's always good to double check. Parking, as most of you know, parking is, during the summer months, a huge issue within Europe, mostly in Italy. There's a misconception with parking that if I send the request for the PPR a year in advance, will I be able to get it? No. What they do is, most PPRs for parking in Italy, and even in most of the areas that do have trouble with parking and a lot of limited space, is that they will issue the PPR sometimes not more than 24 hours before the flight. Hopefully, and a lot of times, we can get it before then, but again, during the summer months, it's very difficult, and those PPRs are limited, and that's why it's not so much on a first-come, first-serve, although it should be. NBAA, the industry, everybody has been trying to talk to the people out there, some of the agents on location, Universal being one of them, a big entity within Italy, to try to talk to the officials there, civil aviation, to see if there's something we can do to better the program, because it's a little cumbersome right now, and I know it's frustrating for everybody as well. Airway slots issued by Eurocontrol come out of the CFMU, sorry about that, Central Flow Management Unit, located in Brussels. Again, it's very tight on the slots for Eurocontrol. The flight plans can be filed 24 hours in advance. The actual slots are only issued 2 hours prior to the assigned estimated departure and only valid for 15 minutes. This is very restricted. If you've got a slot for departure from Eurocontrol and your boss arrives an hour early, chances are you're not going to get a better slot. Same way with the late departure. Now, they also take into consideration delays for the areas where you're going into. That sort of thing can be worked out, and a lot of times we can get the slot that you need, or you can get the slot that you need through Eurocontrol, if it's either weather-related or in something going on at the airport where you are going to. Those slots will be adjusted within Eurocontrol. But if it's simply somebody being late and you're requesting another slot, chances are you'll be delayed. Sometimes we've had people on the ground up to 2 hours, and it can get worse than that. Airway slots, again, traveling within Europe, it all has to do with where you're going within Europe and the traffic flow between those airports. The heavy traffic areas, the airway slots are going to be few and far between, and they will also be 9 times out of 10 not the time that you request. They'll send you your options. You send them your itinerary, they will send you your best available options to fit with your schedule. You'll just have to conform to what they send you. Noise constraints, a big deal all over Europe at the time. As of right now, it is pretty much restricted to only stage 3 aircraft within the EU. There are very, very few exceptions, and that is dwindling to this point to almost nil. We can, at special times, we can get special permission for you to go in, different hours. Again, it all has to do with curfews and the noise restrictions for that particular location. But it's always good, and especially if you have a stage 2 aircraft, obviously, you're going to, it's a lot of work and a lot of planning, a lot of legwork, because you're very restricted on where you can go in and out of. Regulatory issues within Europe, cabotage, if anybody's familiar with it or dealt with the authorities within the EU, you're going to get 5 different answers from 5 different people. It 9 times out of 10 can be worked out, especially if you're on business travel. You deal with one of the local agents there. That's always the best thing, not to deal with them directly. Go through an entity there, whether it's Signature in Luton, whether it's Universal at Stansted, one of the big providers out there, and let them deal with the authorities on the cabotage issues, or even if you have questions on cabotage issues. There's nothing real clear anywhere you find on the web. It's a gray area that nobody can really give you a definitive answer on. So it's always good to double check and ask before the flight. Royal Air Force bases, Northolt, for instance, 14 days prior, and they stick to that. Special circumstances, we've gotten it done quicker, but not much quicker. It's a 2-week process. You have to fill out the MOD application, get it to them, and that application is a lengthy process. It's not a one-page application that you fill out and you send to them. It's a few pages. It's got a lot of detailed information, full crew and passenger manifest, and once it's approved, that crew and passenger manifest, if it changes, you start from the beginning, and you have to reapply. Again, once you're approved to go into a RAF location, that can be rescinded at any time due to any military traffic that may be going on that pops up unscheduled. As far as regulatory issues, visas, everybody in the room here, I know, familiar traveling through Europe. For crew members, visas not required. Handling and parking, again, we touched on this a moment ago. During the summer months, these places are virtually impossible. Again, it's the PPR for the parking that you're looking for. It's not the confirmation of the handling request or fuel or anything else. It's simple traffic flow and parking at the airport. You'll get a message back from UV, for instance, and they'll tell you they've only got 2 parking stands available, and you've asked 6 months in advance. And again, it's a huge nightmare, but it can be worked out. There's a lot of good alternate airports that are really starting to cater to general aviation during these summer months, so that, because they know that they're going to be a high traffic time for them. Security, obviously, it's very good around the airports, sometimes too good, but it's check with your service provider, whoever that might be, for any given trip within Europe, just to check on the airport security, aircraft security, and such as that. Operations within Russia and the CIS. Crew visas are required for multiple stops. They're not required for a tech stop, with the exception of Moscow. You have to have a visa even to tech stop in Moscow. What they like to do is, or one of their regulations is for visas for passengers and for crew for that matter, is to have them prior to landing in Russia. There was a time where your handling agent at that location, Ferris, Russero, they could expedite visas for the crew on arrival, and sometimes, and in some circumstances, the passengers. No more. That's they want to have the visa prior to arrival, and it's recommended only because I just lied to you, so I'm going to have to backtrack. You can get visas on arrival in Russia, but it's not recommended because it takes time. They take the original passports off-site. It's something that I know with my company, we recommend highly, and to get the visas before you go, because it's a lengthy process and it can delay the flight. There have been times when there's something going on at the consulate, they weren't able to expedite the information, and it has delayed several flights out of Moscow. Airway slots in Russia, no ATC slots required, but there are airport slots in Kiev. You have to obtain the landing permit approval through your handling agent at that location before you can obtain an airport slot. It's only like that in a couple of places in the world, actually, but this is one of them in Kiev. You send your information to the handler. They'll expedite the handling request and the landing permit. Then they'll apply for the airport slots through civil aviation. Within Russia, landing permits are required for private and charter operations. There are a couple of exceptions. I'm not sure how much international travel the people in this room, nor most of the clients I deal with, have in those exceptions. However, they are there. That's for landing permits for private and 135. The overflight permits are required throughout Russia and the CIS as well. Handling and parking, again, it's obviously highly recommended to deal directly before you even leave out of the U.S. with one of the FBOs in Russia, whether it be Ferris, Russero. There's actually a few good ones there. And let them expedite all the paperwork for you. The parking, usually it's good. There's not a big issue with it. There are airports within Russia, as you know, Vnukovo being one of them, that for the past couple of years, it's been under construction. From what I understand, it's coming along nicely. They don't have the issues that they have had in the past. But they haven't rescinded the NOTAM yet. So your service provider may send you the information still, as far as handling information, that tells you that there's still construction at the airport and there's parking issues, and you would have to do certain things and park in other places where you had to 6 months ago, whereas now they actually are coming along nicely, but the NOTAM is still out there. So if you do get that information, that's why. Fuel in Russia, we don't have any problems. I don't know of any problems. It's government controlled. Obviously, the quality is good, reasonably priced, and it is pretty widespread and available in most locations. When you start going into some of the more remote areas, I would definitely check with the handling agents. I would go through one of the main areas like Moscow, Russero, or Ferris, and have them check the information out with you instead of dealing with somebody directly in some of the remote areas, because they're going to tell you what you want to hear as far as the fuel goes. But generally, it's not a problem traveling through Russia. Security is actually kind of a big issue in Russia. We like to recommend that extra security not only for the aircraft, but even secure transport for the crew. Most of flight operations and dispatch and owners, secretaries and such arrange the transportation already for the passengers. So what we recommend is for the crew to at least have secure transport, whether it's through one of the Big Fam International, for instance, or even arrange it through one of the handlers there locally. They can also do that as well for aircraft security. We can do it locally, or you can go through one of the big security companies for that. Something that just came, it's not in the presentation, but on my BlackBerry, it was buzzing pretty good this morning. There's a new management structure within the civil aviation in Russia and Moscow specifically, and they are denying the past week, and actually started on Monday, they have been denying landing permits. And we've had a lot of trouble, phone calls back and forth, and there is confusion within the infrastructure of civil aviation. And any change in the crew and passenger data, if you don't resend the entire request to them for the landing permit, they will not tell you until the aircraft is en route that permission is denied. So that's just something to keep in mind as well. Like I said, it's brand new. It's just started happening. Our Ferris representative in Moscow is supposed to call Universal this afternoon to find out what all, if anything, we need to do differently in our requests. And again, that's just something to keep in mind. If anything changes at all, just resubmit the entire request over again. In Russia, the CIS, again, this is very basic information. I'm sure everybody in the room knows. We're just going to touch on it. Different ATC and approach procedures, altimetry standards, because once you get over in that region, everything is metric as opposed to measured in metric feet, as opposed to what we're used to and how Eurocontrol measures the approaches. Weather reporting standards, obviously very difficult. There's a lot of remote locations. They don't have the personnel. It's so desolate in most of the areas that your weather forecast that you receive from any service provider or weather entity will be on historical data. Now, again, that's not going to be for the big major ports in Russia, but more the remote locations, it's going to be on historical data, and that's how they'll forecast the weather, because they don't have the weather balloons and such going off as much as they do in Europe and here in the States. Also a good idea within Europe for some of those remote locations, it's still always going to be recommended to take a navigator with you, especially flying within country to some of the more obscure airports, non-airports of entry. The navigator, not only because at many of these locations there's not enough data available, approach charts, etc., and it's always good to have a navigator with you. It's highly recommended. I'm going to leave this minimum speed restrictions in here. This, again, I was explaining earlier, this I'm trying to, and please bear with me, I'm trying to go off of a presentation that I've never done, so I'm kind of having to keep up with the flow of the person who wrote it. But there is an airway, there's two airways between Europe and the Far East heading eastbound that you have to keep a minimum speed. For the bigger aircraft, the G550s, it's no problem because you can maintain or follow your flight plans at a Mach 8.5 for the entire flight. It's more the autobahn of the airways. You have to, I believe the speed is Mach 8.4 that you have to maintain through that area. But obviously there's other airways. The slower aircraft will just fly on the other airways. But there is two airways between the two that the faster aircraft can get on. And you can talk to your flight planners or your service provider about that. Good tech stops heading that direction, of course, from Europe to the Far East are going to be Almaty, which is highly recommended, and Novosibirsk. Both really good tech stops, good FBOs there, good fuel. There's not much to choose from, but these two have really come a long way. We're only going to touch on the Middle East briefly. There's not that much operations these days within most of these locations. Landing and overflight permits are required for all Part 91, all Part 135 operators. Some of these are great locations, and as you can read up here, it pretty much covers everything. But again, the landing permits, very important. A lot of the lead time is sometimes 7 working days for some of the areas within the Middle East. You have to send them the full itinerary, the crew and passenger data, etc. Health requirements. Modern medical facilities are available. However, it's not recommended. A lot of them, the feedback that we've gotten within the Middle East is that when you go into a hospital or a facility for medical care, they don't understand a lot of the Western way of thinking, and everything's cash payment. There is no charging anything, and from what I understand, the medical care there is really not up to Western standards anyway. General notes, Islamic rules apply, prohibited items, of course, female crew members, bring appropriate dress, don't travel alone, etc. I think that's all pretty common knowledge. Operations between Cyprus and Turkey. The only reason I'm going to bring up these two items under the ATC information is because Cyprus and Turkey have long been arguing over whose territory is whose. So the best thing to do is to request the overflight for both countries, because one claims one area, the other thinks it's theirs. As soon as you hit the fur boundary, they're both looking for the request. And this will take care of it. That's usually what we recommend, and what we do in-house at Universal is we'll go ahead and request both. Tech stops, where you're going to find good facilities, good FBOs, good fuel prices, Bahrain, Dubai, Muscat, crew and PAX nationalities obviously should be taken into consideration in case of a diversion. Asia is going to be very brief. Intensely for both landing and overflight permits. It's required for every place you go in Asia, landing, overflights. And you're going to send the same general information for this landing permit as you do any other. You deal with civil aviation authorities. If you go through your service provider, they'll deal with the local authorities there to obtain these permits for you. Again, in this region, security is highly recommended for both the aircraft and the air crew. Australia, no landing permit required as long as the flight plan is on file, as well as the overflight. The visas get a little tricky in Australia, but not too bad. They're required prior to entry. The crew visa is not required for a stay 90 days or less, with the exception of Perth. For that location, you have to have a visa prior to arrival. The passengers can receive, I know that most of the service providers will offer this service. What we like to do at Universal is obtain the passengers an electronic travel authority or e-visa before they travel. It's quicker, it's easy to obtain, and they can use it for their stay there. And it is also good for 90 days. Operational considerations, most everybody in here is familiar with, and the questions come into our office every day, and I've seen a lot on the NBAA airmail about it, is the aerosol spray or the insecticide spray before landing in Australia. I know that there's a lot of people who's talked about circumventing the system. I know it can be done. But that aerosol spray not only is available, I believe, to be shipped at this point to you. We got a couple of places in Australia. Our agent there can provide a list of names. If anybody is curious or wants to know, just let me know, and I will get with him and send you a list of the places where you can obtain the aerosol. But they like to have it sprayed before the aircraft lands. They want you to hand them the empty bottle. And if it's not, they will spray it for you on arrival. Most people, most crew members, don't like that to happen because they've been known to get a little messy with it when they spray it themselves. Stage 2 aircraft prohibited all over Australia. New Zealand and Australia both, they're great as far as operational needs, landing permits, overflight permits, never a problem. Visas in New Zealand are not required for a stay less than 90 days. No vaccinations required. It's very easy ops. Australia and New Zealand both. Same with the insecticide spray in New Zealand as applies for Australia. The Far East, there is no airway slots that are required for operations to the Far East. Airport slots, however, are required, and they have been, they're very restricted. They're, a lot of times we have problems, everybody has problems getting slots into and out of Narita. There is 370 slots a day, however, with a two-hour window, but the slots on a short request trip or a pop-up trip are almost impossible to get even close to your proposed time. It's always good if you have a trip going to the Far East, and I know a lot of times it's virtually impossible, but as much notice as you can give them, the better. Again, that slot is good for an hour either side, so even if you've got a guesstimate, I would request it. Hong Kong is the other location where you must obtain the landing permit before you can even think about applying for the slots. There's a 30-minute window on those slots, so it's 15 minutes either side of the time that they have sent back approved. Noise restrictions, obviously Stage 2 aircraft also ban in Hong Kong. There's a slight variation for Japan. Stage 2 aircraft are banned only if they're older than 25 years old or a max gross takeoff weight of 75,000 pounds. There's not that much detail to go into about that, so. Regulatory issues. Cabotage rules in China actually are very flexible, believe it or not. If you deal with an agent at any of the locations within China, they can usually get it worked out where you can transport Chinese nationals to one port to another within country. 90% of the travel with general aviation is... They're one of the places that understand that you're going there 99% of the time for business and you're transporting employees within country, so it's actually very doable. Insurance requirements for Hong Kong, the one thing that you have to remember or must want to remember is that the wording on the insurance has to be very specific. They will send your worldwide insurance back to you and say, until it says this, then... The landing permit cannot be obtained. That wording actually is very specific. I've kind of highlighted a little bit of it, but it has everything to do with the third-party coverage, and it's for a single flight. It's not for every flight. You have to get this verbiage put into the insurance for each and every flight into that location. And the third-party coverage on the passengers, cargo, mail, for any single event. Health requirements within Asia, we're not going to be too specific because with each and every flight, you would want to check with the Center for Disease Control. Things change daily. There are outbreaks of various illnesses that only the Center for Disease Control will keep that up to date. Even in-house at your service provider, when you have a trip to Asia, they will check. They're not going to go off information out of the database, which could be old. Fuel in this region, very good. Availability, never a problem. Security at the airport is actually very good within the Far East. They've got good airport security, good security there at the local FBOs, etc. Coming from the Far East back to the U.S., specifically we're going to point out a couple of tech stops that would be good for you. There's not that many choices along the way, but in Nandi's actually a pretty good stop. Apia, Pago Pago, Midway Island is closed to all but military and medical flights, although they people used to be able to operate into there. So we still get several times during the year we'll have pilots that haven't traveled that much to the Far East that still want to stop there, and we have to let them know that unless it's a 135 medical flight or a military flight, they cannot operate in there any longer. The Caribbean, Latin, South America. Pretty easy operations. Most everybody in here is familiar and do your own in that region. Airway and airport slots, not required. Noise restrictions, there's none throughout Latin and South America. The only restrictions you run into is within the Caribbean, and a lot of it has to do with curfews or hours of operations. Many of the airports that have become very popular are sunrise to sunset just because of the lighting constraints. It's always good to check in advance. There's some of the airports within the Caribbean have done wonders in the last couple of years to upgrade their facilities, their runways, their approaches, the whole nine yards. So it's always good to check ahead of time. As far as regular... regulatory issues, permits. You're going to have landing permits for these following countries. Again, I'm sure that most everybody in this room is familiar with operations to Central and South America. The landing permits are no different than any other. Overflight permits, the same way. What you do is you send them the request, your itinerary, the information on the aircraft, give them the fur boundaries you're going to cross for the overflights. The only one... The only trouble we have with any of these locations is with an overflight, and it's with Cuba. Cuba can rescind the overflight due to military traffic in a heartbeat. 5 minutes before your departure, you'll have a permit in your hand, and they'll rescind the permit. That will not be a definite no that you can't operate, but it will delay the flight. And you will find that out from ATC, or your service provider will call you, obviously. Visas, Brazil only, and I put a note on the bottom, conflicting answers throughout the country of Brazil. You talk to five different people, again, you're going to get five different answers. We recommend for Argentina and Brazil visas prior to arrival, because with our U.S. visa waiver program, we have recently dropped Argentina from the program, and their officials have not looked too highly on that, so they have started asking for visas on arrival within Argentina and Brazil. So it's always good to call the particular location that you're going to talk to the FBO or whoever's handling it you at that location to find out the restrictions. Again, you can go 1 week to one location and the next week to the other, and you're going to get two different answers, and so it's always a good idea to go ahead and get the visas. Health requirements, the malaria pills for the Amazon basin, yellow fever vaccination for Brazil, that's a must. You have to show proof of that yellow fever vaccination anytime you come into or out of Brazil. Quality of care, I can't really talk much about this. I don't know that much about it. I can't imagine that it's up to our standards. So the best thing to do would be to check with Center for Disease Control before any operations that you have in those regions. Handling and parking, not really a problem within Argentina and Brazil. The only problem you're going to run into in the more remote locations is the language barrier. Portuguese in Brazil, a lot of times if you go to some of the in-country locations, if you're going into Sao Paulo, chances are they're going to have an English-speaking controller. If you pick up people in Sao Paulo and take them else...
With a gold camera, California, 5 Mike, Bravo, Fox, 933. We need your cargo. Customer with a blue Mini Cooper. License, Mike, November, India.
again. Traveling in country, it's always good at some of these locations. Talk to the handler. Find out about some of these in-country locations, because there's going to be a lot of circumstances flying around South America where you run into locations where they do not have English-speaking controllers. A lot of times your service provider can set up to have... the guy with the Mini Cooper. Sorry about that. Again, going into some of the more remote locations, it's always good. Some of the major FBOs down there can even send an agent with you as a crew member to deal with the controllers, deal with the authorities on the ground. It's always a good idea. Latin America, the quality of service varies greatly, as well as the Caribbean. And most of the travel I know coming up this season is going to be in the Caribbean. Again, it depends on a lot of things. It depends on the, especially in the Caribbean, it depends on runway. I'm lost over words here. The announcement stopped. I don't know what to do. Runway conditions and within the Caribbean. It depends on, obviously, a lot of reasons, how bad the hurricane season was, what's going on during heavy traffic times. They will close down portions of some of the airports for parking. So those types of constraints need and have to come in to your mind when planning a trip to some of these locations, especially during this time of year. I know that in St. Martin, for instance, each FBO this year is allowed to have 7 parking spots, and those are extremely restricted. In fact, they're most likely already gone. Some of these trips to St. Martin have been planned months in advance, and I know the FBO that Universal uses as a primary down there is out of parking spots for the time period after Thanksgiving through January the 2nd. So, fuel. Both availability and quality, both in Latin and South America, is good. Obviously, always check the Caribbean during tourist seasons, like the one coming up, for fuel availability, for shortages of fuel. Not so much the quality of fuel, but the fuel shortage. In Brazil, security is highly recommended, both for the aircraft and for the air crew. The country information that you receive, if you use one of the major security companies, I would recommend having them send you a country brief, even an airport brief, for the locations in Brazil, because those things change daily. And a lot of these security companies will supply you with a briefing that is current. It is current as of an hour ago, whether there's an uprising, whether there's demonstrations going on, whatever the case may be. They can send you that information, and it's very much recommended that you do so. Colombia, can't say enough about Colombia. Kidnapping capital of the world. So obviously security, highly recommended. Most of the airports within Central and South America are not fenced. So every time you have a trip down there, it's always good to have aircraft security. And I'm talking about personnel, not just aircraft tape, security tape, to actually have a guard. It doesn't necessarily have to be an armed guard, but just a guard for the aircraft. Same for El Salvador. We touched on this a moment ago. Cuban overflights can be rescinded at the last minute. It's usually for military traffic, as well as the runway conditions in the Caribbean. Well, that marks the halfway point, which I'm very excited about. I know and have at least spoken to most of the people in the room. This is my comfort zone. Although I deal with international operations every single day on the phone. This is kind of what I've taken up as a hobby over the last 18 years with Universal and kept up with the regulations and so forth. There's a lot of things coming down the road for y'all's type of operation. 135 has drastically changed over the last year as far as customs requirements, and it's coming down the road very soon for Part 91 operators. So it's good to know it now so that you can have a heads up on what's going on. Some very basic information. Part 91 customs updates, very simple. Inbound notification, you call them depending on the airport, which we'll get into in a second. If it's an international versus a landing rights airport, 24 to 48 hours in advance, send them a manifest, the 178 form or the 7507, whichever applies. And then once the aircraft is airborne heading to the U.S., to clear customs, then you give the customs official at that location an updated ETA. Required documents for private, again, the CF-178, which is actually now not only downloadable, but you can actually fill it out on the customs website and print it out from there. 6059 Bravos are the customs declaration, the blue cards. You can order these actually in bulk from the National Distribution Center within Customs. And if you go to the Customs website at cbp.gov and go to forms, you can actually access all of these forms. And most of them you can order from the National Distribution Center, again, in bulk. And the annual Customs decal for all of the aircraft, which is coming up. December 31st, all the current decals will expire, and all of the general aviation will have to have new decals. Requirements for 135, a little different. Over the past 4 years, they've become a lot different and a lot more difficult. To pre-advise customs, we usually will send a filled out 7507 or the general declaration. We follow up with a phone call and obtain outbound verbal clearance, and most of the time a signed general declaration. It's always a good idea. They'll either stamp it, put a log number on it, or they'll put their badge number on it. What they're putting in the computer on their side is a log number, however. When they send that back to you, carry that with you because you can use it. You may get asked for it when you come back into the U.S. Inbound notifications, do the same way as you do 91. You send customs, sometimes up to 48 hours in advance, the manifest. You update them once the aircraft is airborne and en route. Transmit inbound APIS. Again, we're going to get into APIS a little more detailed in just a few minutes, so I will elaborate on that a little more. The required documents, the GENDEC, the 7507, and what is being asked for at more and more locations is the Customs Form 301, which is the customs bond. All 135 charter companies should have a customs bond. The minimum limit of liability at this time is $100,000 for the bond. If you don't have one, definitely get one. I have calls every day from even non-clients of Universal. They're stuck at customs because they don't have a customs bond to produce. And this is something that's being asked for more and more every day. It's always been in the regs. It's always been there. It's the Activity Code 3 International Carrier Bond. On the exact same bond, you'll notice, if you have one, there's an Activity Code 1, which is the cargo, whereas the Activity Code 3 is the international carrier. There's a couple of airports also in the U.S. that you cannot operate into as a 135 without a $100,000 customs bond. That's JFK and LAX. Airports of entry, briefly, most of you already are very familiar with this. Again, international airports, they're usually 24/7, open all the time. You can call them usually with an hour notification. Designated airports that are located along the southern border, they're used as first port of entry for flights coming up on the Atlantic side below the 30-degree parallel, and on the Pacific, the 33rd-degree parallel. If you do not have an overflight exemption from customs, you must stop at one of these designated airports to clear. Most of them actually are 24-hour airports. There are some exceptions, but most of the time you can get in there. User fees varies. Scottsdale's very expensive. Morristown, New Jersey's very expensive. A user fee airport is kind of a young airport as far as customs goes, although Morristown has been a user fee airport as long as I've been at Universal, so I'm not sure when they're going to upgrade that. What it is the local, we just in near Houston, there's a town called Sugarland, and I got with one of our clients. We worked with the local authorities. You actually have to go to the mayor's office in the town to start this process. You tell them the need. You tell them, they look at the airport, who's based there, how much money's coming in, what the revenue looks like, and if they warrant, or if they find it warrants, they will put a customs inspector at that location. Whether that inspector is based there, which at Sugarland, he actually offices with the company that we work with. So that company put them up with a phone, a fax, computer, the whole nine yards. And it is now a user fee airport. You actually have to pay to land. And supposedly that is not a customs fee, that's an airport fee at these locations. That is governed by local authorities, not customs. Landing rights airports, you always want to call landing rights airports 24 hours in advance, and that is to obtain landing rights. Teterboro, New Jersey, for instance, one of the busiest airports for general aviation, and they're very nice guys. We deal with them multiple times a day. However, if they're out of overtime at certain points a year, which they are, they have to deny you landing rights because they can't get inspectors there at the time you need to come in if it's after hours. That is at every landing rights location. LAX is a landing rights airport. I'm sure most everybody in this room has probably dealt with the landing rights desk at LAX. The border overflight exemption program, again, those designated airports along the southern border without an overflight exemption, you have to stop at one of those to clear customs. With an overflight exemption, you can go straight to any airport where there is customs, a customs-manned airport, to clear, whether that be your home base. For instance, if you're based in at LAX, you can go from Cabo San Lucas up to LAX without having to clear at San Diego Brown. And it's exactly what it says, which I explained a few minutes ago. It's anything coming from below the 30-degree parallel on the Atlantic side and the 33rd on the Pacific. Only at L.A. will you need or require an overflight exemption to come from Tahiti. The people up in the northwest coast, you don't have to have an overflight. It's simply the decision of the port director at that location. When the Border Overflight Exemption Program was first brought into existence, aircraft didn't have the range to fly from Tahiti to L.A. It was strictly to try to control drug trafficking. They took into consideration general aviation and the type of traveler that would be on general aviation, and it is a privilege, is how Customs sees it, for them to grant an overflight to any operator. And it is for the convenience of the passenger. It is for nothing else. It's for the convenience of the passenger, and it was to control drug trafficking. So just letting you know that tidbit about Tahiti, since most of y'all are based on this side of the world. There's a couple of ways to apply for an overflight exemption. Online, there is a customs form 442. You can fill it out. If anybody has been in the industry as long as I have, which some of you weren't even born then, But the 442 form looks exactly like the GATE form, if anybody remembers the GATE program, the General Aviation Telephonic Entry Program coming down from Canada to the U.S. It is the identical form. They've just changed the name of it. Now it's an overflight exemption application. You can fill that out, and you can send that to Newark, New Jersey, and your overflight will be based out of that location, or you can deal with the overflight coordinator in your region. The application that I personally use is not the 442. The 442 is cumbersome. It's got enough room to list, I think, 4 approved passengers on it. You always have to put C attached. The best thing to do is to put it in letter format with all of your crew and passenger details outlined and in order. They require everything that you would require to come in and clear customs, names, dates of birth, expiration dates on passports, the whole nine yards. There's two types. There's a single overflight and a term overflight. The term overflight is good for 1 year from the date it's approved. I have one port that actually approves them for 2 years from the date they're approved. You can amend them throughout that time, add airports, add approved passengers, add crew members, etc. The single overflight takes 14 days. This says 15, but it's 14. 14 days per regulation to approve. That has to go directly to the port where you're going to land. Whether you're based in L.A. or New York, if you want to clear in Little Rock, you have to go through the agent at Little Rock or the overflight coordinator for that particular region. Conditions with an overflight exemption, you have to have all of your crew listed on the actual approval letter in order to operate and utilize the overflight. For a term exemption, you have to have one approved passenger at least. Most airports will not let you deadhead using the overflight exemption. To circumvent that, most people will list their flight attendants as passengers. Again, that's not how you're supposed to do it, and if the people at LA found that out, they're the only overflight coordinator that's actually suspended one of my overflights for one of my clients because somebody on the phone actually called customs, let them know it was a flight attendant, etc. So I actually had to redo the entire overflight, putting all the flight attendants back down as passengers. If you do that, it's great. 99 places in the U.S. that you go to know that people do it. So just be aware at that location, if she shows up or your flight attendant, he or she, in their full regalia, then you might get questioned by customs. Managing the exemption, again, anything on the overflight can be amended within the term. Region specific, the overflight coordinators for every region, there is one. For the overflight, for the single overflights, you need to go directly to that airport 9 times out of 10. Centralization, we're getting kind of short on time, so I'm kind of pushing through here. Centralization was put into the Federal Register 3 weeks before 9/11. It never came to pass, but it's still there. It is still going to be in the CFR. And what that is that every term overflight in the U.S., no matter what overflight coordinator, no matter what region, will eventually be based in Newark, New Jersey. That's very important for a lot of operators because they have a very long-term relationship with their local agent, their overflight coordinator. They're also talking about grandfathering the overflights that are already in a specific region and only all the new requests going to Newark. So that's pretty much what we're pushing for. 135 operators, the APIS transmissions, which we were talking about earlier, we recently switched over from a U.S. format to a U.N. format. That is because more countries are going to come online with their own APIS submission requirements. Both inbound and outbound out of all of the countries within the Western Hemisphere will eventually require APIS transmissions. So the UN format is for the United Nations as opposed to the U.S., the United States. It takes a lot of things into consideration. It's monitored by World Customs Organization, IATA approved. I mean, they've gone the full extent on this new requirement. And what the UN EDIFACT is just a message set. It's a new format for the coded message that you send to Customs and to TSA for the master crew list. APIS itself, Advanced Passenger Information System. You send the APIS transmission for any inbound or outbound leg for a 135 charter in and out of the U.S. And again, these other countries are coming online. Canada is looking at the end of the year. Mexico is going to be online very soon. Most of the EU countries will be online very soon. For a very simple, what seems to be simple flight, you could be transmitting 12 to 16 APIS transmissions for that flight in and out of the various countries. The APIS transmissions and the MCL, the master crew list, they're two totally different things. They're governed by two totally separate agencies. The master crew list is kept on file for all 135 operators and commercial airlines and governed by the TSA. When you send an APIS transmission for a particular flight, you're sending both a crew manifest and a passenger manifest. That is sent to Customs and Border Protection. They don't talk about either one of them except for the crew data you send on any particular flight. Once Customs retrieves the information out of it that they need or they require, they shoot that crew manifest over to TSA, who then checks it against that operator's master crew list to ensure that all of those crew members are listed on the MCO. Moving on to the Visa Waiver Program. What is it? The Visa Waiver Program is something that the commercial industry has been doing for years and years. The ability to bring a foreign national into the United States without a visa. General aviation operators, both Part 91 and 135, are participating in this program. We started getting them involved about 5 years ago, and they are rewriting the regulations, because anywhere you look online or in the CFR, it will tell you that this program is not available for general aviation. They just suspended the program for almost a year so that they could rewrite the regulations to include the verbiage that it is open for both FAR Parts 91, 135, all general aviation. So if you made application to be a participating member in the Visa Waiver Program, you could, if your boss is in Europe, he decides he wants to bring one of his friends home with him or somebody to travel back to the U.S. with him, you wouldn't have to turn them down. They wouldn't have to delay the flight so he could go get a visa at the consulate. You would be able to bring him back, just like one of the commercial airlines do. There's only 27 participating countries, and your passenger has to be a passport holder of one of those countries. I mean, you can look at the list. 9 times out of 10, most of your passengers are going to be from these 27 countries anyway. It's obviously going to exclude any of the Middle Eastern descent, but there it is. I started working with this program 5 years ago. 2 countries have been dropped. We spoke about that a while ago. Uruguay and Argentina was dropped last. You don't have to be coming from one of those 27 countries. Your passenger has to be a passport holder of one of those 27 countries. Who qualifies? This is on the corporate level, the Visa Waiver Program. Once you're a contract holder, it covers your operation, how you operate the aircraft. It's ABC Flying Service, every plane that flies under that umbrella is going to be covered. If you add fleet, you don't have to revise the agreement. If you add crew, you don't have to revise the agreement. None of the crew information, passenger information, or anything else about your fleet is given to the government to be able to apply for this program. They look at the financial solvency of the company itself. They look at the history of the company itself. And you being dinged in their computer about getting caught bringing a foreign national into the U.S. without a visa is not going to disqualify you. If anything, it shows them that there's a need for you to participate in this program. The cons, I think they speak for themselves. If anybody in here has ever had the unfortunate pleasure of bringing a foreign national into the U.S. without at least a B-1, B-2 travel visa, the I-94W form, it's green, that Customs brings out to the aircraft is going to cost them $195. I heard recently in Anchorage it's $250. After that, the company, the operator itself, not the passenger. So your passenger really wouldn't be brought or is privy to any of this information. The operator who brought that passenger in would be fined $3,300 per passenger, and that's a given. It used to be the recommendation of the clearing officer. That is no more. It's a given. The fine will be put forth. With the agreement, once you have a signed contract, you also have the I-94W cards. You have everything you need to be a signatory carrier into this program. U.S. visit program, it's been around for a little while now, so everybody's pretty familiar with it. Any foreign nationals coming into the U.S., visa holders, passport holders or not, they have to at least be fingerprinted and photographed at your first port where you clear customs. Most of the places have the facilities now. Teterboro have them both at Jet and Atlantic now. The only place that they're not is right up until the restriction was Van Nuys, did not have the remote equipment to do U.S. visit. Didn't mean you couldn't operate into there, but they didn't have the equipment to do the fingerprinting and the photograph. This just basically is a rundown of what the U.S. visit program, the acronym itself, stands for, United States Visitor and Immigrant Status Indicator Technology. And all of the information processed goes into the computers, IBIS, the whole nine yards, and is logged. You only have to do this one time. The visitor to the U.S. only has to do it the first time they come in. Agriculture, pretty cut and dry. Still don't like to have any meat, beef, or milk product, byproducts coming into the U.S. Coming into a lot of airports, you have to physically call a decaterer to remove the international garbage. If there's not an incinerator on site and the FBO does not have a compliance agreement with agriculture, then an actual Sky Chef or one of the other catering agents will have to come remove the international garbage, take it somewhere either on-site or off-site to discard of it. The reason I brought that up, it's the operator's responsibility to notify the decaterer at a location where there is no agriculture facilities. It's one of the reasons why if anybody's ever tried to get into Green Bay, they don't have any facilities or an incinerator or any catering agents that decater aircraft. You cannot operate into Green Bay unless it's Canada operations only. If you're coming from Europe into Green Bay, and I'm giving you Green Bay as an example, there's several airports like that. You have to stop in Canada or Gander or Goose or one of the others. Make sure that you talk to the FBO at those locations and say, I need you to remove all of the international garbage before I can operate to the U.S. That's it. I'm sorry, we ran kind of, I was pushing it at the end. I apologize to you, but, and that was my favorite part, the end. Spent too much time on that other stuff. Thank you all very much.
Do you want to take some questions?
If anybody has any.
Does anybody have any questions for Laura?
Hi, Laura. Will LAX drive out to Van Nuys? As I heard, they weren't driving out to Van Nuys any longer.
Both Van Nuys and Burbank for now are cut off as far as customs goes.
And Long Beach as well, right? This airport, because LAX used to drive to Long Beach to meet you.
Well, there's actually a local guy in Long Beach. So, and I don't know if that included him. I mean, I can find that out for you, but I almost want to say it didn't, because I had somebody clear in Long Beach just a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
But Van Nuys and Burbank for sure. We have to clear at LAX right now.
And when you file flight plans or do the flight planning, do you use Midway as a possible divert airport,
where?
Midway?
Midway?
Yeah. Or do you just consider that off limits?
No.
When you're doing your overseas?
Right. Well, obviously that's such a remote location. That's such a remote location, and you're coming over water. If it's a true weather diversion or an ATC diversion, they're going to let you land. There's nothing but water around there, so they're going to have to let you land. And that's anywhere, no matter whether it's your alternate or not. If it's a true weather or ATC diversion, they'll let you land. Thank you.
Question over here.
Laura, with regard to LAX and border overflight permits required, with the exception of Tahiti, as you mentioned, could you restate the requirements? Is LAX considered a waiver airport? In other words, that you need the overflight permit?
Yes. Yeah. If you were coming up again from, for instance, Cabo, you would have to have an overflight to clear at LA. I mentioned the Tahiti thing because it's been a longstanding joke within customs and all over the rest of the world that LA, the port director there, has made a call on their own. Washington, even I got Washington involved about 10 years ago to dispute Tahiti requiring the overflight for LA, and I still have the email from the guy in Washington over customs in Washington that says no, this is how the program was set up. Aircraft didn't even have the range at that time. Tahiti wasn't a factor. That would be like me telling you, because your Global has the range to go from Africa to New York, you need an overflight. Well, it's not the case. But what we do is we play the game. We put Tahiti on the overfly. Most of the overfly coordinators, both Newark and Dallas and all the big ones, they know that if we put Tahiti on an overflight, that they must have a trip to L.A. coming up. Because no other port in the U.S. requires it.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you all very much.
That's great.
I'm so glad that's over.
You did fantastic. Let me turn something off in the back of the lighting.